Bienvenue to the Two Chons podcast, a show dedicated to the belief that you can never have too many bikes in the garage and it's always a good day for a ride. And now, here are the Two Chons.
Welcome to the Two Chons podcast. I'm John.
I am also John.
You know, that beard of yours is getting pretty thick.
It's the post-cross beard. Yes, it is.
This one was kind of delayed because before, I thought the beard is like the Great Pumpkin. As cross season came, it filled out.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed that there's a proliferation of pro cyclists with mustaches?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I always figured it's because you have to be a little bit trimmed.
It seemed like the first one was Zabriskie. He had the mustache.
Yes. Yes. Well, I guess you have to go way back with like Eric Van Lanker. He kind of had the.
The 60s. Yes. But I mean, like the modern day mustache. Zabriskie had it, which was sort of weird. People didn't know what to do. But now, you know, young Stetna has one. What's his name? Eric Docker? Mitch Docker from Australia. He's got a big mustache.
I thought that Deccan Kolb had one a little bit ago.
Right. He's got the thin, pencil-thin mustache. Facial hair is accepted now in the peloton.
It's the expression of, you know, a man's individuality in a sport where we all kind of look the same.
Well, you have to have the goods to back it up. For instance, when Pantani, he certainly had individuality, style, and flair. And, you know, he had the shaved head and he had the bleach blonde goatee.
Yeah.
Like also VDB had it, but he had the good. Both those guys had the goods to back it up.
Yeah.
Facial hair still is sort of still not as bad as a facial tattoo, but facial hair in the pro peloton, it is not begrudgingly accepted, but it's like, haha, okay, you know, that's good. Now get to work.
I think it's beyond the novelty part of it, but and face tattoos will not ever be accepted. I don't know where face tattoos came from.
Because of
was it Klingler?
Klingler, right. Who showed up at the I'm getting my teams in history wrong. I thought it was a French team.
I think it was Festina.
Festina with the Maori facial tattoo. Did not work.
But who's this guy? You go home. I don't think our sponsors want you there. Although I bet during the days of rock racing, I bet face tattoos would have been welcomed.
Cale Legrand is now, he got an 8-year suspension now. His last one when he tested positive at the Dana Beach Criterium at age 40 or 39 or whatever.
I did read where Ricardo Rico is coming back.
Mm-hmm. Again.
He of his self-transfusion failure.
Yes.
Speaking of all of those shenanigans, John, have you been following the Phil Guymon, Fabian Cancellara?
Yes. Pretty funny.
It is funny. All a publicity stunt.
On whose part?
Both.
Oh, for sure. I think they're both of the publicity stunt. Well, I think self-deprecatingly, Guymon would say that his post non-retirement is sort of a publicity stunt. I mean, it's a worthy one, sort of, you know, to unseat dopers, KOMs on Strava, and to speak out against dopers using the platform. And on Cancellara's part, I think it's sort of a Swiss, you know, little man, you never made it. It's just jealousy, and I'll show you. Yeah. I think it's unwise on Cancellara's part to engage this.
I do too, because, okay, Cancellara, I'm not throwing shade on anybody, but all right. So you rode for Giancarlo Ferretti's team in the early 2000s. You know, okay, motor doping, whatever sort of dope. It's just not a good idea. We've talked about somebody else in the past who probably never would have gotten in trouble and would still be the seven time or the five time, whatever.
Yeah.
However many times, but he kind of just kept it going, couldn't stay out of it.
Asking for trouble, I think, is what it is.
Yeah.
So globally, thinking about the subject, this is the question that I'd like to ask you. Which is worse, in your opinion, pharmaceutical doping or motor doping?
I think motor doping's worse. I think because of the context. I think that in the context of all of it, all right, so somebody takes a little extra preparation. It's not a motorbike. You know, there's no pretense. There's absolutely no pretense that it's a motorbike. But there is I think that there is a little pretense of, well, you know what, I took my inhaler or whatever, you know.
I think so, too. And I just from what you read when this all started to hit the news, different people's takes, very interesting. It's split from what I can see. Some people say, oh, you know, no, motor doping is not worse. But I think motor doping, I think, is a lot worse.
Yeah.
Now, worse in the sense that you are turning a sport into a different sport because it's not a bicycle anymore. But certainly not worse for your body. Is it worse for the sport to motor dope or to dope dope? That I'm not as cut and dried on that. Is it worse for your body to pharmaceutically dope versus motor dope? Yes, absolutely. But in the sporting sense, like the cheating sense, I think it's a worse cheat to motor dope than to pharmaceutical dope.
Yeah, I do too. And to go back to our Icarus conversation, a guy that has a good doping program doesn't automatically make him, you know, world champion. I mean, imagine that. You know, I bet his chances of doing better or his chances of improving his place would have been higher, removing a lot of the variables, had he just put a motor in his bike.
Now, I'm not up to date on the motor technology and how long they last, and I've never seen one. But presumably from what I understand, to use the motor, they don't last for that long. And some of them may be just like the stage on the rocket where once you light the fuse, it goes and you can't turn it on and off. So you have to get to the point in the stage or in the race to actually benefit from using the thing, you know, if you're going to win. So you've ridden 2/3 of the race and now you need 20 minutes with 100 more watts. So it's not nothing to get to that point where you can use the thing.
Time it when you get to one of the decisive short, steep climbs.
Yes. Like the Zapruder film with Cancellara and Sagan, where he's like stabbing at the handlebars. Or is it? No, it's Cancellara and Boonen.
Boonen, yeah.
Right. Up the Kemmelberg or the Koppenberg, one of the bergs.
When you're talking about selective boosts like that, I think of one of my favorite James Bond movies, A View to a Kill, where Christopher Walken, I forget what his baddie's name is, but he has a little button in his cane, his gentleman's cane, when he's at the horse races.
Uh-huh. and the horse, and it somehow like injects the horse with a drug, or what does it do?
It like releases some sort of doping drug, and then the horse can just jam the last 500 meters.
And he controls it from the stands with his cane?
Yes.
Oh, wow. So maybe boy, if you really got advanced, like the DSs, if they were close enough and they could see on the broadcast or see their riders, they could control the release of the engine.
Right. Like, can't they, if they're, they have the video cam, they have the video in the car, they're watching the races, and I don't know, I'm sure they're getting some sort of audio report. And,
radio tour.
All right, here we go. Time to, it's about to get a little bit easier, Peter.
Time to unleash the hounds.
Right.
So, purportedly, Cancellara now, and I was in the presence of the Big C a few months ago working at an event, and he was there. And anyway, so I'd never seen him not in a race in person, like just standing around kind of thing. And he still looks fit and trim, and then apparently he is, because he's doing a series of race with Fabio or Fabian, or
it's like
chasing Cancellara. Chasing Cancellara. And that is why, you know, Guymon, he's smack talking him in social media, and Fabian's like, bring it on. Come to one of my things and see. Put your money where your mouth is.
Right, I'll show you. I didn't motor dope.
Yeah, I'll show you. I'll kick your teeth in. And Guymon's like, okay, let's. It's on. Game on. Let's go. it is like I heard somebody compare it to the, you know, the Bobby Ray, like compare Cancellara to Bobby Riggs.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And so I guess that makes Guymon Billie Jean King. Spoiler alert, she won.
Yes. And by the way, that was the first in the last podcast. We had Jason Gay. His first podcast was an interview with Emma Stone promoting that film.
Oh, yeah.
Which I didn't see the film.
I didn't either. I really want to see it. I've also heard Stone interviewed about the tennis training and how not only learning how to play tennis, but learning how to play in the style of the time, and then learning how to play like Billie Jean King, you know, and then learning how to play with the old equipment. And she said it was really cool. It made me want to see the movie just for the technical aspects of all that.
Yeah, same here. So I was having this. Have you seen? Isn't there a Tonya Harding movie out?
Gosh, yes.
So
Jeff Galooly, wasn't that her husband?
Yeah, Galooly. They pulled a Galooly when you beat somebody up with a club.
Did one of those two go on to have a career in adult movies, or both of them?
I thought Tonya did. I don't know if it was adult movies. She posed for Playboy, didn't she?
Okay.
I thought she did. But I do remember there was an audio call where where she was like beating up her husband or her boyfriend or something, and he called the cops. And he's like, come on over, cops. She's a convicted felon. I've got nothing to hide.
Did she do jail time?
I think she did. It's kind of sad, though. My point is that when they were making the film, like, Tonya Harding was technically a really good skater, I guess. And so they're like, all right, let's get somebody to do this triple axel move that Tonya Harding did. Well, it's not like you can just go out and find any stunt double that can do that. Like, there's a handful of people in the world that can do that, and she's one of them.
A handful of women in the world still that can do a triple axel.
Right. So that's kind of like, wow, you know, I can't just... I think they ended up doing it with computer effects. I don't know. I didn't see the Tonya Harding movie. But when you hear that, you realize as much of a train wreck as her life may appear from the outside, she could do some amazing things on skates.
Okay. Two figure skating comments. Number one, the Olympics this year... It is going to be revolutionary, John, because they can now skate to music. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready. I'm sitting down.
With lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
Woo! Mind blown. Woo-hoo. Okay, number two. I just don't understand a sport that doesn't have, that has subjective judging. I can't accept it as you win, you lose. Maybe, and I know, oh, I don't know the intricacies and that. It's like, it doesn't work for me. Like a winner and a loser in a sport that's subjective.
You want absolute time. You want a metric.
Distance, time.
Distance, time, right. But what about, how about, and I kind of lump them together, the snowboard, like, slope style and half pipe.
Right, and that's a metal sport, yeah.
And that's a metal sport, yeah. Well, not only that, I think it's a very popular metal sport. I think, people will watch it, but...
Which is the mass start one, where they race against each other? And
border
Jerry
cross
of the day,
right? You probably like border cross because that's like Ultimate Fighter. Right. I got down first.
This year they're going to have mass start, not short track, but mass start speed skating. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. Wait, so this is the long track? This isn't like the roundy round, the short roundy round?
No, not short track. This is the big one. Oh. I don't know if it's half a kilometer, a quarter of a, I don't know if it's 222 meters, I don't know how long it is around. Sorry, folks. But they're going to have mass start. I guess they have pairs, right? Where you have to stay in your lane and then you can cross over after a certain point and the Dutch always win.
Yeah.
But they're going to have mass start speed skating. That'll be good.
Yeah. How many start? Do you know? I mean, mass start. Is this like...
Don't know.
They have call-ups and stuff?
Going to be like cyclocross on skates.
Wow. Diving into the first turn.
Yeah.
First lap hero.
Blades of glory. Go for the whole shot.
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to the Olympics, even though
likewise.
There's no bike racing.
I want to see the North Korean marching band in the cheering section.
if you had to distill the Winter Olympics to one sport, maybe two sports, what would they be?
You mean sport or the discipline of that sport?
Okay, the discipline. We'll say the event or a couple events.
Well, I would say downhill skiing, and you have lots of events. Jump. Well, I guess you wouldn't call jumping downhill. That's more Nordic or jumping. Ski jumping is like you're like the place kicker of skiing. Or the holder, maybe, the long snapper. But I think skiing, downhill skiing.
Yeah, downhill. Whether it's downhill, GS, or Super
Nordic
G.
Nordic, or slalom, or whatever.
But I would split Nordic, though. So those would be my...
Oh, for sure. Yeah, okay. I said downhill. Downhill, okay, not yeah. skiing. Downhill skiing.
All right.
And... of Winter Olympics. Although I don't really like to watch it that much, I guess I would say bobsledding or sledding.
Oh, all right. So, yeah, the sliding stuff.
Sliding, right. The sliding sports, which is like the gravity mountain bike racing of the Winter Olympics.
It kind of is, yeah. And it starts out so tame. Like, I mean, those guys crush the launch out mm-hmm. of the gate, but then the sled's going like, you know, it's going like 5 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour at the very top. Anyway, that is interesting because you look at like the men's downhill course. Have you ever gone to a place where they've had the Olympics, like the Winter Olympics, and had the men's or even women's downhill?
I've been to a Summer Olympics, but not the Winter.
Those runs are incredible. It is... When you see them on TV and then you see them in person, it's way more extreme when you see it in person. How the pitches are just incredible.
They're apparently trying to make it safer after in warm-ups for the last Olympics, the luger died, and the Olympic Committee tried to blame it on the sledder and not the course. So there are efforts made now to make courses, skiing and sledding, not so dangerous. Mm. Like, enough is enough. Sort of the same comments that cyclists are making, like in the cyclist union, like, you can't expect us. We know it's all about the show, but enough is enough. You can't make us race down a mountain at the end of a long stage just for the entertainment of everybody. There are lives at stake, literal lives at stake.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can have entertainment and a good sporting competition without risking life and limb.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of the downhill, the Super G, the giant slalom, but my other sport still in the skiing family would be biathlon.
The Nordic combined?
Yeah. Well, yes. Maybe, wait, so let's see, is that the combined? Isn't that like,
I think the shooting and skiing.
I think it's the skiing and the jumping.
Oh, right. That's the skiing and the jump. Right. The biathlon is the shooting.
Yes. Yes. I think that, all right. So to me, that's one of the best because you have a time and then you have to shoot something. And I'm a big shooter, but, you know, there's something primal about, like, all right, a skill and you're at like 200 beats per minute.
And if you don't hit the target, then you have to go into the little penalty area and ski like an extra distance. Not that you have to stop and just wait. You actually have to ski like a little maze to get back onto the track.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. It's punitive.
Mm-hmm. And they wear, at least in the Sochi Olympics, a lot of them wore Rudy projects.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Brico and the Rudy projects there. So it's basically they take cycling glasses and put the stretchy strap on the back, and then mm-hmm. they can put it up on their foreheads. If they had caps, I'm sure they would gently place the glasses on top of the cap above the bill.
Right. Yet another example of, now, of course, cyclists are very egocentric, and we think the world revolves around cycling and cycling stuff and equipment and style. But yet another example where cycling trickles down into mainstream. Oakley, right? I don't know if Oakley Motorsports and Oakley Cycling started simultaneously, but I think it was cycling first. But now Oakley is a household name.
Yeah, you know? Well, I think it was the motorsports, like the dirt bike stuff.
Okay.
Like, I remember as a kid having Oakley grips. You know, and there were goggles and that kind of stuff. And then there was the factory pilot.
Well, okay. So a more recent example of cycling stuff trickling down into mainstream is that this week we now find out that the bad people and terrorists of the world can pinpoint ID with a map of the perimeter of these secret bases, because soldiers are Straving their runs and workouts and like running the perimeter of some secret base where you shouldn't, nobody knows where they are. Did you see this?
No, I didn't.
So it's this big revelation to everybody that, oh, if you upload your Strava workouts, anybody can see it. And there's the Strava heat map, and you zero in places of the world where they don't think any soldiers are, and you can infer from all these workouts in the same shape that, oh, wait a minute, that's a base, and there are people there working out. So Strava has unwittingly, one of our listeners was put up his Strava workout today, and I said, be careful, somebody's watching. But, yeah, Strava, again, now Strava's a household name. Strava started, of course, in cycling. So, you know, the I'm better than you, ultimate prize, look how fast, look how many watts, I'm training so much. So now Strava's done everybody in.
I know, you're a hater. You're a Strava hater. I'm
not so much. I'm a hater of why do you need to know my business? That's what I'm a hater of. I have a Strava account. I do have a clandestine fake Strava account that I use when I'm in France, but I don't have one here in the States.
Is it Tommy V?
Well, there's another name in the news, Vocaler, and going back to motor doping, but Vocaler, did you read the headline today about Vocaler?
I didn't even know what that article was. Like, why would you bother writing that article?
One of the comments on Cycling News was he thinks that there are hidden motors in Tommy Vocaler's jaw muscles to make him do all those faces that he did.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just like anything else. It's, you know, he says, I don't know, but my opinion is, yeah, that might be a possibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you remember how big bike computers were? How big do you think a motor would have been in the early 2000s?
I mean, I guess small enough to fit inside a bike.
That's true. All right. Tommy Vocaler. You don't hear the former French housewife, the other former French housewife's favorite, Veronk, talking about that stuff. That maybe he had a motor.
A correction to last time's podcast, the great Cadell Evans road race was not before the Tour Down Under. It was after, and it happened recently, and an Australian won, so good for the Australians. Hurrah, hurrah, huzzah, huzzah.
All is good. All is right in the world now.
Interview.
I'd like to welcome to the podcast Elle Anderson, Belgium-based cyclocross racer just getting ready to go to the World Championships in Valkenburg today. Elle, thank you for joining us, and good morning or good afternoon.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Today, you're heading to Valkenburg to take part in the World Championships. You'll be doing the elite women's race. Wow. What's part of your preparation in going today? I mean, there's so much stuff that you've got. You know, all of your equipment. I mean, you're okay. So today's Wednesday morning. The race is Sunday. Talk me through some of the high points of your preparation before Sunday's race.
Definitely. And number one, I had to take care of early this week was some good recovery. I raced both days last weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Sunday was a World Cup. So I think the first order of business was really good recovery and really taking care of myself all week. I really woke up Monday morning feeling hungover in a very specific post-race weekend way. I just really had to focus these last two or three days on just eating really good food. I think I slept 11 and a half hours, not joking, wow. On Sunday night. These are all these key pieces when you have such a big event coming up and you are doing big events consistently leading up to it. So after kind of some recovery, I've already gotten my training ride out of the way today. Got a little rainy, but, you know, just 90 minutes to shake out the legs. And then tomorrow I'll really be focusing on my first time training on the course. So that's going to be another really important piece of the preparation. I've raced Valkenburg before as a World Cup twice, but the course I hear is a little bit different. Obviously, it's a different time of year. It used to be in October, and obviously now we're racing Valkenburg in February. Early February. So that's going to be really key to really start to get a visual of the course, see the different lines, see any changes that they've made in the conditions. Other than that, just really organizing the equipment, hanging out, being very relaxed, all the good things.
Mm-hmm. And where are you based now? Where will you be traveling from?
Yes. So I live in a town called, well, it's kind of a city, Ostende. It's right on the sea. It's about 20 minutes from Bruges. And I live about a kilometer from the beach.
Wow.
The famous, beach of the sea where, you can pretend you can see England, but you can't. But right across the channel.
All right. And how long have you been having a Belgium-based cyclocross season?
This is my fourth season being over here in Belgium. So it would have been 5 years ago that I first came over for, you know, as a naive American racer, I first came over to do a short block of races in Europe. And then it was just the next season that I first committed to a full season. So it's nice. It's finally, you know, last year and this year was the first chances that I really got to feel established, to feel settled, to feel really integrated into the community and how everything works here. And so reflecting on that time and all the perseverance that it's taken to get here is pretty satisfying, and I'm really enjoying it.
Great. So did, there's a couple riders. I mean, we were in the podcast, we were talking about the retirement of Jonathan Page, who was a guy that I would see as one of the early guys that kind of went and did a Belgium-based program rather than kind of going back and forth. A lot of people read about Katie Compton this year doing a more Europe-based program. So did you run into Katie a lot this season? I mean, I think you've your last race you may have finished, you know, you two were right together. Did you, let me put it this way. I'll just go to the next question. What do you see as the big difference between doing a program there and, say, you know, doing a largely U.S. based program?
So many differences, I think. It depends on even where you want to start. I remember from my first season over here in Europe, what really stuck out was just my development as a racer and as a technical rider. The courses here tend to just be in a class of their own, so to speak. It's really, I remember absorbing so much my first year, and actually every year I learned so much. There's so many intricacies of the sport that I feel, for me, I really feel pushed to overcome and to learn more when I'm based over here, just because of the atmosphere. It's a total different feel as well. Like, to take that on a different angle, the sport here has a much more professional feel to it, where you show up to a cyclocross race and you're there to do a job. It's almost transactional in a lot of ways. It's not as much about showing up to an American style cross race and hanging out with your friends and having this community feel. It has a bit of a sharper edge to it, where you really feel like you're part of an industry, there's this economic force behind it. There's this TV coverage. There's the sense that you're all professionals. You all take this very seriously. There aren't any amateur races on the day. So it all kind of raises the level. It raises the bar in such a major way. And it's something that really drew me to Europe, because it was so inspiring to me to really be part of this environment where not only was the sport taken so seriously by the fans and the spectators, but also the other competitors were so kind of serious about it. And that may sound like, oh, that doesn't sound fun at all, but it really is. It's a different kind of fun. It's a very kind of, you aspire to be one of the greats. You pursue it in a way that kind of comes from, you know, a place of kind of chasing it for your career instead of just, you know, your weekend gig. And it really, I just feel that my development in the sport over the past couple of years have been so driven by the kind of the atmosphere here and the style of the cyclocross races, the courses, and also just the cultural aspect of what cyclocross means to the people here.
So you don't have people in costumes racing, and you don't have maybe 8 hours of bike races that go from single speed to
age-graded races to – so there are – is it distilled down to what, maybe four races typically? Is there the elite?
Four
and
or
then,
five.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
They usually start with the really young boys, then go to the juniors. Sometimes they allow women's juniors to start, but it depends. Then you have the under 23, and then women's race, which is usually under 23 and elite together, and then you have the elite men. So it's four or five.
Okay. So excuse me. I put the bat signal out that I was going to be interviewing you, and I just got a message from Australia from one of our listeners, Skip. And he says, "Good day. Would you mind asking Elle what skills has she developed from cyclocross that have changed her road riding style?"
Yeah, I think one interesting one that I was just working on this summer is to refine my cornering technique. It was really interesting. I spent a bit of time kind of in the August prep block for this season, doing some drills on the grass, taking some hints from mountain biking, actually, in terms of how you position your hips, how you rotate into the turn, how you pedal through the turn to maintain traction. And surprisingly, all those skills really work also when you're descending or cornering on the road as well. So it's so nice. It's so fun to play around with your body positioning and different technical aspects. And it's also nice when they cross over to the road as well. But overall, I think that work really helped me in my cyclocross racing this winter, really helped me on the technical courses. And then I can also feel it carry over when I'm just out road racing or road training as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you, so obviously you ride the road, you ride the cross bike. Do you mountain bike?
I do a little bit. I tried a mountain bike race in this past July in Vermont while I was visiting my parents, and it was a very interesting experience. It was a smaller race, but it was still a UCI race, and I was up against some very talented American mountain bikers, and I pretty much felt a little demoralized because I just felt so out of my element. And over the 2.5 hour race, I was 15 minutes behind the winner. Mm-hmm. It was a very different experience for me, and there were A lines and B lines, and there were drops, and I felt very unprepared.
So is there would there be a is comparing the U.S. circuits to the circuits you're running in Europe, what would you say are maybe two or the three biggest differences, you know, as far as features? I mean, you mentioned on the mountain bike race having dropped and a couple other things that may have caught you out. When you started to make the transition, what types of features did you see?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different ways. It's hard to generalize, but there's maybe a couple different features or kind of conditions that come into play. One is that cyclocross in Europe tends to occupy a pretty small space when you compare it to the U.S., which is a massive country. So there tends to be kind of consistent conditions throughout the season. You know, you'll sometimes have a hot cyclocross or a dry one or a wet one or a cold one. You know, there's some variation, but not like I see in the courses in the U.S. And also the weather is pretty consistent through all the different regions that I will race. And so, and there's something about the soil consistency. You could even make a claim for, but one of the biggest things is you get to a certain point in the season and it's just the rainy season. And so every course is just a complete mud bath. Mm-hmm. Every course is just going to be a slip and slide or, you know, just a tractor pull or like a whatever. You just, at a certain moment, you get this consistency where every race seems like the most epic muddy cyclocross race you've ever been to, and it's just normal. So that's one interesting angle. And then, you know, that one time I'll get a dry cyclocross race and I won't have to do 2 hours of cleaning afterwards. It's just heaven. But the other thing is that because there aren't amateurs on the same day, I find that the course builders are more daring in some of the features that they put on the course. You know, it's not across every race, but you'll find races that tend to have, they just highlight these features. I mean, it's a real spectator sport here. So I find that the course builders want to highlight the almost acrobatic skills of some of the pros. They really seek out these features on the course that will really push us to the limit. Mm-hmm. There was a course early in January, and it had, you know, it was regulation width, but it had only a single track kind of cut into this forest. And so, you know, you were really kind of going down this gully almost, and it was very steep, and you had to kind of put your weight back, and then they had a 9-degree turn at the bottom of it. So it was one of those things. It's like you're pre-writing the course and you kind of had to plan time to spend, you know, a good chunk, 10 or 15 minutes on that one part of the course to even get the confidence to do it, let alone race it. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple experiences like that where I've had where, you know, just completing the feature seems to be a victory, and you have no idea what's going to happen in the race with your heart rate up higher, and maybe you'll have to run it anyway because your motor skills are just a little bit lesser at that moment. But that's just kind of one example of how sometimes there's technical features that I feel just really push me as a technical rider and really are that driving factor in my technical development.
Yeah, I get that. Excuse me. I get that in that, you know, that's one of, as a spectator, that's one of the interesting things to watch and see how everybody negotiates those kinds of, those features differently. You know, some are just like, forget it, I'm running it. And some will try to run it. And as a participant as well, you know, it's figuring out and kind of solving that mystery. So coming up to the Worlds, do you want to talk about your equipment a little bit? Like, what will you take with you? I'm sure you're watching the weather to see, you know, to help inform that. What's a typical haul of equipment that you'll take to an event?
Yeah, wow, it is a lot, but I'm so used to it now that I almost don't blink an eye. I did look at the weather. It's supposed to be pretty cold, actually, getting down below freezing or just at freezing at night, which is pretty rare around here. Usually it doesn't get that close to freezing. It's usually in the 40s, but it's going to be pretty cold. I'm fully integrated in centigrade these days, so I just know it's going to be 4 or 5 degrees max during the day. I'll let you do the math. But it's going to be cold in Valkenburg, so I'm going to have to bring all my warmest clothes. In terms of other equipment, it's pretty, I don't know. I feel like some U.S. cyclocross riders would be surprised that 3 bikes is the absolute standard here, if not more. So 2 bikes, really, I mean, it's just, it doesn't really cut it. 2 bikes is one or more too few. So I'm lucky enough to have 3 identical cyclocross bikes. One I do most of my training on, so it's definitely not always as race tuned as the others. So it's kind of my, you know, last option, but there's a lot of races where, you know, I'll have 2 spare bikes in the pit. And that's really important because at a certain level, I mean, there's only so much you can do if you rip a derailleur hanger or something like that. You know, there's just not enough time to service that bike. You always need that one extra bike. And also a lot of times there's 2 pits. Okay. So you actually have 2 different mechanics and 2 different pits, but in Valkenburg, we only have 1 pit. So that's fine. But yeah, so it is really interesting. There is definitely, and also because you don't have to fly as much to get to the cyclocross races, you just load everything in the van. It's a lot easier. So 3 bikes, and then I have 6 pairs of racing wheels, 12 total if you want to separate them out. But I have 3 profiles for mud, challenge tires, that would be the Limus. And then I have 2 sets of the Griffo all-rounder, which I'm guessing I'll ride in Valkenburg, but I'll have to figure that out tomorrow. And then I have 1 pair of slicks, the Dunes, and those are what come in handy at a World Cup like Coxsite or another sandy race. So
All right.
Yeah.
All right. That's interesting. Yeah, it is a lot of stuff. Yeah, and 4 to 5 centigrade does sound a bit chilly. Well, is it normally windy or typically windy there or not?
Well, it's typically windy here on the coast, but I think it will be pretty okay there. Another angle on the equipment too is, you know, it's not only about the bikes. I travel in a big Sprinter van. And so in that Sprinter van, we also have the water tank. We have the generator. We have the pressure washer. We have the air compressor. We have a table and, ooh, a camping toilet. Very handy.
Right.
Because there's never restrooms at the races like there. Like, there's no line of porta potties ever that I've seen. You can find one or two, but not the participant style ones. Got all the spare parts, and then, you know, I hang the bikes vertically in the van and kind of position all the wheel sets around. And so, I mean, then you have all the rain gear for the mechanics in the pit. You have all the boots. The poor Sprinter van is really chock full, but it just gives you an idea of, everything you need to kind of show up for a real cyclocross, a real muddy cyclocross race.
Yeah. And you can, I guess with all of that stuff, you can control as much of the environment and what goes on with you as possible. So you just focus on the race. How did you get into cyclocross? Was it from the road, or were you doing something completely different?
I was really lucky. I got into cyclocross my fresh sophomore year in college through the university team. So that was a really nice way to enter the sport. I mean, I really entered the sport of cycling while I was in college as well, because I was a ski racer before and I kind of retired or phased out of that. And I just knew that the college I went to had a cycling team that was pretty good. So I'd always kind of put it on my bucket list. And I joined the team. I did some college races my freshman year. And by the time I got back to school, sophomore fall, everyone was talking about the cyclocross thing. And I kid you not, I'd never heard of it before. And I was just like, oh, what is this thing that you speak of? And so they said, yeah, come along. You can watch the race this weekend. I watched. And then the next weekend, I found a bike to borrow. And I participated. And then the next weekend or the 2 weeks later, I'd already bought a bike. Already full into it. So,
was this in the Northeast? Where did you go to school?
I went to Dartmouth College in New Hampshire.
Okay.
There's a lot of just really great racing, iconic courses in the Northeast there. So it's just such a wonderful way to get introduced to the sport and to be able to race the New England circuit for a couple of seasons there before I started doing the real pro races and traveling.
Nice. And you mentioned skiing. You come from a family, like your parents are athletes as well. What do they think of cyclocross? I mean, do they get it, or are they kind of like, well, you know, I guess Elle's in Belgium. I don't know what she's exactly doing, but do they get it?
They love it. They really love it because I feel so lucky that I have parents that I feel really understand what it means to be a pro athlete and to really pursue something overseas. But they really enjoy it. So my mom did her fair share of racing in ski racing in Europe, traveling by herself, you know, spending the whole winter in Europe, going to the Europa Cups and pro race. I don't know. I love that I was able to grow up having my mom as such a role model, as someone who just competed in skiing all over Europe, did really well, and was able to support herself for about 10 years in the sport, and grew up kind of seeing all her trophies in my grandparents' house. So it was a really cool experience. And my dad, too, I mean, he did a little bit of road racing in Europe, but probably more road racing in the U.S. So I have this kind of mix. You know, I take a little bit from my mom, a little bit from my dad. And I really kind of use that as inspiration to fuel my pursuit of sport. And they're always there at home tuning into the coverage online and texting me as soon as my race is over. And they're just so sweet.
Yeah, that's great. And it's got to be, I mean, having parents like that know, that understand the investment and the high level and supportive of it is, it's got to be huge in doing that. We have another question from when I put the bat signal out, and normally we give people a nickname if they write in. We'll call this guy Mr. Lapel. Can you ask Ms. Anderson what has been the best part of living or racing overseas and what she misses most stateside?
So it's hard to pick one thing. What I love most about racing over here. Well, I'll probably pick a few things, but I think one is I love to be able to race against such amazing competition every weekend. It's, you know, something where as an American rider, you might think, oh, I'm going to go race in Europe. Then I'm going to have this amazing international world-class competition at these races. But when I base myself over here, it's every weekend is almost a mini World Cup. And as tough as that can be sometimes to fight for a top 10 or fight for a top 15 at just a regular Belgian cyclocross race, it's also what I love so much about being over here that it's in a little bit, it's just such the heartland of cyclocross right now. And there's just so many talented riders that are now coming here, that are coming to this area to race from the US and also from parts of Europe and beyond. So to really feel like every weekend I'm lining up with some of the best racers in the world is just such an amazing gift. It's such a great opportunity. And it can be so hard because I never hardly ever get an easy race, you know. Sometimes go all the way to Spain for a podium or a win or whatever. But it's really what I love so much about it. And I love that women's cyclocross is doing so well in Europe right now that even in my short time, few years here, I've seen women's cyclocross coverage go from a 5-minute recap on TV to the full length race. And that's just been so huge. And everyone's been commenting the whole season about how exciting the women's racing has been and how diverse the field is, how deep it is. It's been really just so fun to be a part of that. And I would kind of tack on the other favorite thing about being based over here is just that cyclocross matters in such a deep cultural way where everyone tunes in. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like American football. Everyone kind of knows who won that weekend. It's the same here. Everyone kind of knows, you know, everyone at least saw the news article or sat down their couch and watched the whole thing or even came to the cyclocross race. So I just, the most random people that I feel should have no connection with the sport will know everything about my last races, right? It's just, it always stokes me out. So it always cracks me up when I just can really feel that this cyclocross culture is just totally encircling me. And I mean, there's no break, which can be a potential downside, but again, it's just so immersive. And then if I were to pick something that I missed from the US, I would say that I do miss sometimes the vibe. I mean, I tend to say so many wonderful things about the racing over here, why I like it so much, but it's never to take away from what the US has built for their cyclocross community and their cyclocross circuit. Because yeah, I mean, it's how I started in the sport. I know US racing well. There's just something so friendly and so welcoming and so kind of inclusive, but like not in a bad way, in a really great way. It's just such a community driven sport in the US that I do miss showing up to a race and just having so many friends be there and having it be such a social event. having it be relaxed in that way. When I show up to a race in Europe, it's, you don't chit chat, you know, you kind of go in, do your job, and you get out as soon as you're finished. Mm-hmm. Right. So I'll always miss the kind of low key, very social and very community driven scene in the US. It's really a really nice contrast. And I think that both regions have some really great highlights to how they've developed the sport.
All right. Well, I guess kind of focusing back on the upcoming Worlds, what's looking forward to it, what would be, I mean, what's your target, your goal? Who are your picks for the win? And then I think I have just one other question after that.
Okay. First up, my goal. Okay. So I think it's hard for me to like say really, you know, a placing that I would like to achieve at Worlds. I think there's been a couple of years where I've been 14th or 15th. Last year I was 11th, which was a very good race for me. So it kind of, it's just, I think, difficult in a way because part of me wants to improve upon last year. Part of me wants to at least have a top 15 like I have in previous years. But there's a whole nother part of me that's really recognized that this year in particular, women's cyclocross has just been phasing into a whole different speed of growth. And there's a couple more mountain bikers that have shown an interest and have come out to all the races. And I've struggled to stay in the top 20 at the World Cups just because it's not that I'm getting worse or I'm staying the same. I'm probably improving. There's just so much talent and so much development coming to the women's side of the sport, which is amazing. But at the same time, it makes it very hard for me to think about improving on my 11th place last year. Of course, I'm going to go for it. Of course, I'm going to try to get the best place possible. But it's also with much respect for all the other competitors that are taking the line. And I just think that I have to fight for every meter, every place, every lap in the race this Saturday, and just really hope for the best and just see what I can do. But it's something that it's really just an experience I'm looking forward to. I don't try to put a lot of pressure on myself and try to say you should get this place or you should have this kind of result. It's mostly about just embracing the experience and having my best race.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Second question.
My second question was I thought that I may have had two part, but that answers that question. Maybe your results haven't steadily gone up, but as you're saying, it sounds like the fields are getting more competitive and they're getting deeper in the women's side. But you have, I mean, I've followed some of the results. You have had improvement. What do you think that improvement is attributed to? Is it just getting, an accumulation of little things that you've learned, or has there been one big thing or a couple major lessons that you've learned? It's like, once... this is how I do that to not get into the trouble I was getting into before.
I think the mental side of the sport has been the part that has most impacted me, I would say, over the last couple of years, which is an interesting position to be in because a lot of people, a lot of athletes or even, you know, anyone would assume that the physical side of the sport is the most important. For me, I'm always going to be focusing on that, right? It's always so key to get the right preparation for the season, and to constantly evolve that process and that preparation. But at the top level, at a certain moment, you know, everyone's so fit and everyone has been training so hard all summer. So for me, the greatest battles have been mental. Especially given that 4 years ago, I had a really tough season, my first season in Belgium that was really disappointing and crushing to me in a lot of ways, psychologically. And I feel that it's been a lot longer of a journey to kind of come back from that and to develop the tools I need to race with a good mentality, to let myself, to let my body physically perform without, you know, capping that by some mental mindset of fear or disappointment or you know, just kind of being not as prepared for it mentally. So it's been so challenging. And it's been a struggle at times, but I think that over the last 2 or 3 years, I've made a lot of progress in how I mentally approach the races, the kind of tools that I use. And I just can't say enough about how important that race day mentality is that you have to work on all week. Mm-hmm. Really have to work on that focus, work on your expectations, work on that mindfulness. Even if you do all of that, sometimes you can still, have a bad mindset in the race and something will happen. But for me in particular, I see such a big difference with the races that I really let go and just perform and get in the flow, and the races that I'm really, you know, feel the pressure. I put too much pressure on myself and my legs just feel terrible and the results reflect that. So mm-hmm. 5 years ago where it was my weekend gig and I was still working full time at Strava. I still work part time there now, but, I mean, so different when you're full time employed by someone. I mean, you can only do so much and your mindset is just so different. You're a regular person who does cyclocross, not a cyclocross racer who is sometimes a normal person.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know. It was just inside me that when I got that chance to flip it around and instead of being a normal person that sometimes does cyclocross to reverse that, I mean, I just like didn't even blink an eye. Mm-hmm. It was crazy. And there's some consequences that come with that decision too, because I think I put so much pressure on myself and sometimes you take it so seriously and it's just so makes or breaks you when your successes and less than successes at that, you know, when you so deeply invest in something, that's just such an inherent struggle that I feel so many top athletes struggle with. But for me in particular, really, you know, you can't take that switch lightly.
Yeah. And it's probably like, you know, you're so invested in it, it probably becomes part of you and it's kind of probably a balance of, you know, keeping who you are and separating that from your results or, you know, really getting down on yourself.
I struggle with that so much. I mean, yeah. I mean, just like, for example, if let's just say I don't have the greatest race in Valkenburg, it's going to be a real challenge after that race to not feel like I'm a total failure or that I failed myself or that, you know, you get so many bad mentalities that just come up. But I have to really just work all the time to be like, yep, I'm a person first, then I race cyclocross. You know, you can't let it consume you.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess isn't that part of the lesson, especially in cyclocross or in bike racing? I kind of think of it a little bit like a batter in baseball where, you know, you're a really, really good baseball player if you hit the ball, you know, 30% of the time. And so that's another 70% of the time that you're failing. And when you fail 75% of the time, you know, how do you pick yourself back up? And yeah. Do it again and try to improve and, you know, just over and over and over.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I'm going to remember that. That's a good one.
The sun's not coming up here yet. It's still dark, but it is getting slightly lighter.
I'm impressed you got up so early. And I appreciate you contacting me and doing the podcast because I don't have a lot of ways to really connect with US audiences these days. You know, sometimes I do feel like I'm out of sight, out of mind, and that I do think my stories and experiences would be interesting to the US folks, but it's just, I don't always have a great way to bring that across. So I always appreciate things like this.
Oh yeah. You're more than welcome. And it's interesting to know that there's, you know, somebody, there's people out there that are pursuing this at a high level. And they're not doing it traveling around the U.S. or, I mean, it's one thing to do the U.S. circuit, but to do it and immerse yourself the way you are at the, you know, really in the hotbed of cyclocross in the world, you know, that's pretty cool. So nice. Yeah, we're glad to do it. And as you know, if you ever listen to the podcast, you realize that we are not professional podcasters. I am an individual who happens to podcast.
You seem very professional. I would be sold.
Don't let the microphone and the headphones fool you. We're enthusiasts. We love the sport, and you know, both John and I have been involved in it for a long time, and we just, you know, I think that there's multiple facets to the sport and many ways to enjoy it, and competition is one part. You know, and you know, between the road, the cyclocross, and off road, I mean, it's a great sport and a great endeavor, and when you get into the competition part of it, it also that's a whole nother mm-hmm. thing to get you kind of revved up.
I know, it's great.
Well, Al, thank you for the time, and best of luck in Valkenburg. We'll be following along.
Great, thank you so much.
Okay, the World Championships of Cyclocross are this weekend, and I was looking through the start lists and the U.S. start list, and it's great that we have all these Americans racing, but Vanderpool, who do you think is going to win?
Probably Vanderpool. I mean, he's dominant.
Dominant. Then he's not in the rainbow jersey.
Yeah.
Wout van Aert is in the rainbow jersey, and Vanderpool has pretty consistently just kicked his ass this year.
Yeah, well, isn't that that seems to be the case sometimes, kind of frequently, where the guy that wins the world isn't the guy that is really consistent or dominant. You know, they pull something out, like Lars Boom. He was world champion, wasn't he?
Boom!
Yeah.
You know,
he beat Niels Albert and why am I drawing a blank on the guy that retired?
Nice.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I would be shocked if Vanderpool didn't win.
It's a lot of pressure though. There's a lot of variables, as you know. Yeah.
So, race this weekend, we may have some interviews with some of the U.S. athletes either before or after
yes.
the race. We hope. We're working on it.
Yeah, those ought to be pretty interesting. And, you know, either hearing their nervousness beforehand or their thoughts beforehand or their epilogue to a season.
Mm-hmm. And if it holds true in the announcement today that Jeremy Powers is retiring, could be his last, well, it probably most certainly will be his last world championship. But, you know, the news today that the Aspire Racing team is folding or ceasing to exist and that Powers is retiring after a long, long career, which started on the road. And then he was one of the early guys to go to a full cyclocross schedule after, I think, Tim Johnson did it first.
Well, think about this. How about another guy that retired this year?
Page.
Jonathan Page. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, he was the first, was he under 23 world champion? I thought he was world champion, or maybe he just did well at Worlds.
He podiumed at Worlds. In the elites.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if he was... I don't think he was ever world champion. I know he wasn't elite world champion. I'm pretty sure he wasn't U23, but he did podium at the Worlds, which put him on the map. I mean, on the world map, you know, an American podium mean at Worlds. But yes, you're right. He also retired this year. Yeah. And he went native. Like, he did the Le Mans. He moved to Belgium, moved his family, and did the full career over there.
Yeah. Looking forward to that. So, you could be podcasting right now, or you could be getting ready to watch the State of the Union address, Or
edit that part out.
Or you could be, you know, Sunday's a big day. You've got the Cyclocross World Championships and you've got the Super Bowl.
The Super, oh gosh. Don't you think, I think the current UCI president, LaPierre, that's not right, but it starts with an L.
Yes.
He should give a state, perhaps he does, but he should give a public state of cycling address.
Yeah. Like
he's making a statement by his non-attendance to the Tour of Flanders because a certain former professional is going to show up for some ancillary talk the night before. And he said, I advise against it. Okay, you're still going to do it. I'm not coming. So I'd like to hear his thoughts. I'd like to hear him do a state of the state of cycling, pro cycling.
Yeah, and hopefully it would be more than just a sales pitch trying to convince us that how great things are.
What do you think the state of pro cycling is? Road cycling.
I think it still struggles to have credibility. I mean, you've got, think about this. All right, so you have the biggest race on the calendar every year, right? The Tour. And name for me a Tour rider that, the last guy to win it that you can say, oh, that guy was clean.
Cadel Evans.
Yeah, we did that on the last podcast. So I think if you have your biggest race and there's a question about it and that question goes on, it goes back so far. Yeah, I think you have a problem. I think you have a problem. And I really think that if it weren't for that's going to sound bad, but Sagan really brings a lot because not only do you have that credibility issue, but you also have kind of, maybe not great racing, but when you have a guy like Sagan who can win and he also takes risks and he's not so specialized that, he doesn't apply himself in other situations. All right, I'm only going to go for the sprint. No, the guy gets in breaks. He works on hilly stages. I mean, he's a dynamic rider. And I think that aside from the credibility thing, I think that I think it's kind of lacking a dynamic rider or more dynamic riders.
Sagan is all those things, and yet they kicked him off the Tour.
Right. And you know what? They came back and, after further review months later, yeah, we shouldn't have kicked him out. Yeah.
I think that was a mistake. At the time, I thought it was a mistake, and I still think it was a mistake. Do you think...
Everybody thought it was a mistake. I mean, that's the odd part.
Do you think that Sagan is clean?
What I can say is if he's not clean, it would be devastating. I hope he's clean, but I don't know how you do that and be clean. Do I think he's a normal person? No, I don't. But the amazing thing I think also is you look at what the guy can do skills wise. Again, another former mountain biker as they infiltrate the road riding. But I don't know. I think that's the whole credibility question. So I think it does. That credibility question really hurts cycling.
Cycling's lost credibility, even with its diehard fans.
Yeah.
And people who race.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, to me, that's the biggest problem. And the symbol of it is look at the biggest race on your calendar every year. You can never be sure that the guy is going to not get some sort of adverse analytical finding.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, when's the last time you watched a whatever major sporting event, golf, soccer, football? I mean, football, they overturn, they say, oh, is this right? Is this wrong? And replay stuff drives me crazy. But after the game's over, the game is over. You know, yeah, they suspend Tom Brady last year for 2 games for Deflategate, but you don't finish a football game and say, well, maybe they're going to change the result.
Yeah,
it's never changed. It is what it is. And so then people would say, well, it's because cycling and cyclists are the most analyzed and tested people, and our criteria is, our bar is so high, and we're so sophisticated. Maybe cycling should not be so sophisticated in its testing.
Well, I think then it would be like baseball and football, and
when the game's over, it's over.
I think that their testing is more of, you know, window dressing. And you have a players' union that's like, no, you can't test for that. that's not a good idea.
You're from the Cleveland area, John, right?
Toledo area.
Speaking of baseball.
All right. Yeah. What's his name? Well, let's call him like Yahoo.
Chief Yahoo.
Chief Yahoo.
Chief Wahoo or Yahoo? Chief
Wahoo.
Chief.
I was never really an Indians fan, though. I was more of I followed Detroit sports more. Truthfully, I'm really from Lambertville, Michigan.
I mean, what sports are up there?
Nothing. Dirt biking.
Well, okay. Well, speaking of Michigan, last week it came out that the age group winner of the 2017 Iceman Cometh race, John, age 58, I would say his name, but I don't have it in front of me, so I'm not going to out him on the airwaves, but you can read about it. He refused, John, to take the test. Apparently the bloodsuckers came, the pee doctors showed up after Iceman Cometh, which is a mountain bike race in Traverse City, Michigan, refused to take the test. And then in the world of cycling, of course, you know that you're admitting your guilt. If you don't subject to the test, you're saying that's as good as testing positive.
It's like a breathalyzer.
It's not the same as a breathalyzer. If you're not admitting your guilt.
No, aren't they? When the cops pull you over, don't they say, like, all right, you're not going to blow into this?
Because they're trying to intimidate you to do it. You can say, I'm not going to do it on the side of the road. Let's go to the station. I want somebody else present. You know, gives you time to sober up. No, you're not going to drive, of course. But no, you don't. You're not admitting your guilt so much as with your USA cycling license, you have subjected yourself to the USADA guidelines, and you're saying, if you don't take the test, I'm admitting my guilt. And this guy, who's 58 years old and won the ultimate prize for the 55 to 59. He did a really good time. I looked up his time. It's a sub 2 hour time. So he's suspended for maybe 4 years. It's like two or four year suspension. The hammer has dropped in Northern Michigan.
Wow. The Iceman Cometh.
The Iceman.
I bet he's a roadie. I bet he's a roadie that's like, I'm going to go up there and crush it.
He does. I looked at his results. He does a lot of mountain biking. There's not much to do in Michigan, by the way. He's from Traverse City.
Oh, he's from, okay.
Yeah, so it's like I go up there. My parents are up there. I've probably been on a group ride. I've probably been desperately hanging onto his wheel. His chemically enhanced legs churning up and down.
Man. Wow, less than 2 hours.
He has a 151 or something.
Wow. Yeah, so John, I remember that race. I was like, oh, it's like a long mountain bike race, but you know, that event has been going on forever. Uh-huh. you know, and it's, you know, now you have the whole category of like marathon mountain biking. You know, it's even a USA Cycling. They have a national championships, marathon mountain biking national championships. You know,
and they have, I think the fat bike, by the way, mountain, the fat bike nationals just took place last week.
Where are they? They have to be in somewhere out west.
No, I think I don't know. I saw Frankie tweeting about it.
Oh, does he fat bike?
Yeah, I think he's announcing.
Oh, all right. Another fellow Michigan guy.
Michigander from Dearborn.
Yeah, you know, we've had him on here twice, haven't we? I think we have had him on. You interviewed him once and I interviewed him once.
Okay.
Well, so do you want to do some listener feedback?
Oh, yeah. Let's do it.
All right.
Do we have any?
We do. We have two.
Okay.
And, John, how would people get a hold of us if they want to interact?
If they would like to send us an email, you send it to johnspodcast@gmail.com. Tojohnspodcast@gmail.com. We have a Facebook page. Which is To John's Podcast. We have Twitter accounts. And we also, John, have a presence on Podomatic. It's linked in our Twitter description. And I think there's a link on the Facebook page, too. But on the Patreon, or excuse me, on the Podomatic site, we have this Patreon button, people may have noticed. And this week, John, we had our first Patreon pledger, and you can pledge a one-time amount. You can pledge like a monthly amount, and I don't know if he does or does not want his name read, so I'm just going to say Michael became a Patreon supporter, and he's pledging a certain amount every month. So the podcast, John and I, believe it or not, I know it's hard to believe, but this is not our job. But although it's not our job, we like to do a good job. So there are some costs associated with the podcast, hosting, equipment, time. So if you feel like you want to make a pledge, we certainly appreciate it. You can go to the Podomatic site, Podomatic Two Johns Podcast, and click on the Patreon link. So thank you, Michael.
Yeah, thanks. It's a little bit of a little helps us keep things going a bit because we do pay for some of our bandwidth, which we do go through a considerable amount of it.
Because we have so many great listeners listening over there in Hertfordshire.
We should, you know what, John, with Podomatic, we should give a shout out to the different countries that where people listen to us. Have you looked at this? So we can tell
yes.
If you're listening, and we have some Parisians that are listening.
Just like Skype, and we know, or not Skype, just like
Strava.
Strava. We know where people are. Not exactly, but okay, so the country isn't Uganda on there or something?
Here we go. Honduras. Somebody's listening to us in Honduras.
Hola.
Denmark.
Guten Abend. No, that's German.
The South Africa. And, of course, our magpie-fearing Aussies. Ireland, France, Netherlands, Norway.
All right.
Global.
Canadians, too. Or did you say that?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I guess I just bypassed Canada. You know what? There's no China. China Todd must not listen to us.
Right, or no, he's probably because he's under surveillance. He's probably
right.
VPNing.
Right. It probably shows up. That's probably the one that's Honduras.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's get to the emails. Tojohnspodcast@gmail.com. First email, to John's. So you go out for a pack of smokes 5 years ago and show back up like nothing's happened. Well, I have moved on and have been seeing other podcasts. I have a relationship with the Slow Ride podcast and have been on a few dates with the Speed Metal Cycling podcast. We'll have to take this slow and see where it goes. Regardless, cyclocross led to gravel, and eventually last year I bought a mountain bike. I signed up for Leadville, not thinking I'd get through the lottery system. I finished well enough to get a silver belt buckle and did no harm to myself or others. A success. I saw a large variety of bikes, but almost all were hardtails, and I don't recall any 29ers. Tire sizes varied a bit, but most had less aggressive tread, and there wasn't a lot of technical sections to worry about. I also got to ride with Floyd Landis and Dave Zabriskie for a little while. Good to hear from you guys again. Your pal, Godot. And he encloses two pictures with Dave Z and Floyd.
Yes, and that is a full beard. Actually, he's looking kind of, Dave Z is looking a little bit like your beard.
Yeah.
And Dave Z's sporting a visor.
Yeah, mountain biking.
Yep. Yeah. So, John, would you ever consider doing Leadville?
Sure.
Yeah, I think you'd probably like it. I've never done it, but it's not, from what I've seen, it's not technical. But it does seem like a slog. I mean, I'm not saying it's smooth, but, you know, you pedal it. I mean, people do it on tandems.
Yeah, it's hard. I've talked to a number of people that have done it. And it seems like it's a difficult ride. Well, it's altitude.
Yeah.
Long race.
Yeah, good job, Godot. I mean, a silver belt buckle is nothing to sneeze at.
Nope.
All right. So does he sound a little bit jilted?
Well, yeah, he sounds like we left him. Like
right.
He was like sitting there watching a television show. We're like, hey, I'll be right back. Going to get something at the store.
I'm
going to
go out. I'll be back. I'm getting some smokes.
Yeah, he sounds like sort of a child in need of some counseling, some therapy. Should we feel bad about that? Kids always complain about their parents.
I don't know. I mean, I was trying to figure out if I should feel bad or not, but I don't feel badly. No,
I don't either.
No.
But we're glad you're still listening.
Yeah. All right. The next email. Dearest two Johns, I know. Thanks for getting back to me regarding mountain bikes. I have had a 29er hardtail. It's been great. Done 4 XC races in the 25-mile range on the same course, taking time off each year. Not sure Leadville will ever happen. Seems a great idea till a tough ride and says, yeah, right. Seems a great idea. Anyways. Also done many short track races or summer cycle crosses, I like to think of it. What do the two Johns think of Zwift? I know John G has spent some time there. Likes, dislikes, observations. This is from the Can Be Crosser and more. John, I'm noticing a pattern here, and I think that you might need to get used to this.
Mountain bikes?
Mountain bikes and not paved riding.
There's a mountain bike park opening in June in Cincinnati.
What? Where?
In Lebanon.
Ah, it's not like underground or under some overpasses.
No, it's like a reclaimed dump or something.
All right. So kind of like Valmont in Boulder. Where,
was Valmont a landfill?
I don't know if it was a landfill, but that's a bike park. You know, it's got it's got pump track and, you know, kind of some skills courses.
There's in Kentucky. Have you heard of the... God, what's it called? It's the...
The one in Louisville?
It's in Mammoth Cave. It's in a cave. It's underground. It's in a mine. It's the... Oh, darn it.
Yeah, I thought that was in Louisville.
It is.
That's kind of the one
I was... Cave.
Oh.
What's it called?
Yeah, I have seen that. I've never been there, but I've seen it. It's kind of like a skate... It's a little bit like a skate park.
Right. Mega Cavern. That's what it's called.
So, John, I have to say something. So, speaking of Valmont, and this isn't why I brought it up, but they have some really cool programs there. And one of my nieces was involved in one, and it was called Little Bellas. And they would have, you know, there's some really good riders, some very accomplished riders in the Boulder area. And some of the women would come out and kind of teach these young girls, like 8 to 12 years old, how to mountain bike, you know, how to do. And I remember my niece riding down the Belgian steps, you know, just crushing them, and she, you know,
wow,
yeah, you know, and it was a whole group of them. I was out visiting one time and went out there as their class was or their program was wrapping up, and it was really good, really a cool program. And I think they did it once a month. You know, just a little shout out of some of the cool things that go on in those bike parks.
Yeah, Valmont is great. We were there for nationals, and super. It's very nice. So back to the email. Zwift. Yes, I've been Zwifting for a couple years. I like it a lot. You must to get full enjoyment. A smart trainer is a must. I mean, you can link into Zwift. You can have a cadence sensor, a speed sensor, a heart rate monitor, and do the rides. But a smart trainer, one that gives you resistance or not, and really simulates up and down and drafting and wind and stuff, it completes the experience. It's a fabulous tool to do targeted workouts. I certainly do a ton more riding indoors, and maybe more in general than I normally would in the winter because of Zwift. My only complaint, but this is purely self-inflicted, is I find it very difficult to do an easy ride on Zwift.
Oh, so I need a little bit of an education. I'm a bit of a Luddite in terms of this. What exactly is it? Is it because I see people post stuff on Strava that's like, oh, so-and-so did a Zwift ride.
See, this is like the double loser. If you're Strava-ing your Zwift, I mean, first of all, Strava, you're comparing yourself to somebody that's not there. And then on Zwift, you're like, my wife comes down and she's like, just shakes her head. I mean, it's a video game. It is a video game. With other people playing at the same time, but it's a cycling video game, and it's amazing, John. Next time you're here, I'll let you do it. It with a smart trainer, it accurately, as long as you set it up with your accurate weight, it will simulate climbing and descending. Like I know if I'm climbing a 7% grade, what gear I need to be in to go this speed at this watts, and this is what my heart rate's going to be, and it accurately depicts that. Like, how does it do it?
How?
How does it do it? Because it's interfaced with your smart trainer. I have a Wahoo Kicker.
Okay.
So, with a flywheel, you know, you take the rear wheel off. There are all kinds of smart trainers, but it gives feedback to the trainer based on the terrain that you're riding on in the Zwift world.
Okay. All right. So it's like Zwift has courses.
Yes. Okay. So based on what day it is, there are right now, there are three different worlds that you ride in. The main world is the island of Watopia, and it's their own island. It is an actual island, but they've overlaid roads on this island in – it's where the plane crashed and lost. Was that in Fiji, I think, or something like that?
I figured this would have some sort of lost connection.
And so they've overlaid these roads, and you can choose to do different loops. Hilly loop, flat loop. They now have a volcano circuit. Am I echoing? You're making a face, John.
I'm looking at the track, and I'm seeing that there's some sound coming in when you speak. and it's supposed to be just my track. And it's not okay. My cat.
If it's echoing, we apologize. It will... I can't remember where I was. Oh, Watopia. So that's one of the worlds. The other world is London, and you can ride the London Worlds course or a short version of it. And then the other course is Richmond, Virginia.
Oh,
and they have buildings and people standing on the side of the road. And
it gives you – it does it feel realistic?
Realistic as you can get.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
I was pretty amazed. Like, if I'm going down a hill, since I'm a light rider, I have to pedal fast to go. You know, if it's a 7%, 8% grade, for me to maintain 35-plus miles an hour, I have to put some watts out. But somebody who's heavier doesn't. And like I said, as long as you set it up with your accurate weight, I have to pedal. Like it, or somebody who's heavier than me doesn't. But here's the other thing. You can draft.
That's kind of nice. So you do that work, you bridge up, and it's like, that makes it worth it.
So this is why I found that it's hard to do an easy ride, because, you know, I'm riding and people are like, you can also customize your avatar with like sock height and skin tone and glasses and jersey and haircut and all this stuff. It's pretty funny. If I want to do an easy ride and I'm trying to like, okay, I'm going to keep the heart rate low. I'm going to keep the watts at this level. And then somebody passes me. I'm like, oh, come on, buddy. You can also see the names of the people who are riding around you, what country they're from. If you click on it, you can see what level they are, you know, like how many miles they've ridden and what level they have achieved. You can chat within the thing. I usually have the app up on my phone, so you can like chat. I've done group rides. There's a local, some local teams here that they have set races every night of the week or a certain night of the week. It is
okay.
Awesome. Zwift is awesome. You pay $10 a month for it.
Okay. I've never done it. As you may guess, what I tend to do is I have this room, it's like an 8x8 room, all white walls, white ceiling, concrete floor. And I have a pair of rollers in there and I go in there and just ride the rollers and I enter my mind palace. No stimulus. Look at this, John. Looks like
a late entry. We just got an email.
You want to read it?
No, go ahead.
All right. So anyways, Camby Crosser, hope you enjoyed that. The next email, Justin. Oh, if I had some papers, I'd shake them. John's. So since I missed all the podcasts over the last couple of years, I'm observing your progression into a kinder and gentler two Johns. Years ago, there was a lot of fun to be had at the expense of long chain bikes, people who wear helmet straps over sunglasses, bibs over jerseys, etc. Now you are more evolved. However, Voluminati has taken the baton in a more harsher tone. On a serious note, do you feel we will ever have a clean tour?
Thanks. No, we've already covered that.
Love the podcast, The Wright Brother.
How do you know who wrote Voluminati? I don't want to say it, but like, you know, put some, add up the pieces.
Different personas.
Although John has been around for a while, this book comes out.
So I do have to say, all right, here we go. You know, it's been cold lately, and in the winter you wash a lot of clothes. You know, you've got like tights, the jacket, and all the base layers you're wearing, and the overshoes, all this. And then the thought occurred to me, like, you know, if I rode a recumbent, I could just take a blanket.
like the pensioners lounging on the deck chairs,
right,
with a woolen blanket draped over them.
Right. Like, if you ride a recumbent, having a windproof blanket is a viable way to stay warm while you're riding your recumbent. Just something to think about.
It's like, well, no, even better yet, those, when you get an X-ray and the people still have to be in the room, they get those.
Lead apron.
Yeah.
I love the lead apron.
That's what you need.
I do.
Because if you're riding a recumbent, most likely you're sterile anyway because you have admitted and given up.
Well, that's why you're riding the recumbent for, you know, less pressure there.
Oh, right. That's okay.
You ever, I mean, I think like when I went one time at the dentist, I think I almost fell asleep because of the weight of the lead apron.
It feels good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does feel good.
It's like when you put, what are those, the thunder shirts on dogs that are freaked out in a storm?
Oh, I don't know those.
It like swaddles them, holds them tight. It's the same thing, like the pressure.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. Huh. All right.
Okay.
And you know what, listeners? We're sorry. I'm out. We have no more specialized Team Lamprey shoe covers or gift socks. You're just giving your feedback for the love of the game.
If there's anyone out there listening that would like to sponsor the feedback segment of the Two Johns podcast, we'd be happy to entertain that.
Yeah, I think Stomach of Anger ran its course. They're no longer doing t-shirts, but it's good while it lasted.
Now, of course, we're not just going to take any sponsor. We might have to. We'll interview sponsors, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. We're taking interviews for sponsors. Or if you're a manufacturer or you rep some sort of product and you'd like us to review it, send it to either of us and we'll give you a very honest review. And we'll talk about it on the podcast.
Indeed. All right. Again, email address is twojohnspodcast@gmail.com.
All right. John, I think that's all I've got for this edition of the Two Johns podcast.
Indeed. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.
Yo, you have been listening to the Two Johns podcast. Want more of the Two Johns? Follow us on Twitter at www.twitter.com/podcast. Or send us an email. Enjoy your ride.
Oh, yeah.
Be safe, get real. Oh. And if you ride with the Two Johns.